The Politics of Policing Part 2, the mayor of Austin pushes back against the governor's call to take a pledge not to defund police. That and more today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. Coming up, our conversation with Austin Mayor Steve Adler, who says characterizations of major cutbacks in the Texas Capital City's police funding amount to GOP politics as usual. We'll hear more. Also, changes to the sex ed curriculum in Texas. LGBTQ students say proposals are woefully inadequate as social conservatives push an abstinence-only message. And the threat to a burgeoning industry. Texas wineries teaming up. All that and a whole lot more when the National News Show of Texas gets underway. And that happens right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this Thursday. I'm David Brown, and later today, Governor Abbott is set to hold a news conference asking politicians statewide to sign a pledge not to defund police. The defunding issue a rallying cry in many cities nationwide this summer after protests over the killing of George Floyd and police brutality. Last week, Governor Abbott threatened to back legislation that would effectively put the DPS in charge of the police department in Austin, where the city council last month voted to slash $150 million from the police budget, a move city leaders said was not a defunding move, but a reallocation of most of that money to other social services. Joining us now, the mayor of Austin, Steve Adler. Mayor Adler, I guess I should start by asking if you plan to sign this pledge by the governor.
You know, the signing of this pledge is concerning to me because I think it's suggesting that there are, in fact, political leaders in the state, none of whom I'm aware of, that support defunding police, or that the city of Austin defunded the police. Police are important, and it's an important function, and I don't know anyone that supports it. So the pledge itself seems to be another kind of political move and casting an impression which is not true. And I think that that's dangerous and stops us from having the important discussions about public safety that should be happening. And I think that it's an effort to divert attention away from what is the greatest public safety crisis we have right now, which is the virus. So I don't support the kind of the politicization and the rhetoric revolving this issue. I wish we were having a more serious conversation. I oppose and I believe that I don't know any political person in Texas right now that's supporting defunding of police.
A lot of people talking about Austin City Council's decision to cut and reallocate, if I'm not mistaken, a third of the police department's budget. And clearly, Governor Greg Abbott and some Republican leaders in Texas have taken notice. What do you make of the proposal that the governor has recently touted that would allow a takeover of the Austin Police Department effectively by the Department of Public Safety?
Well, need to begin with, I think the governor's reacting to something that we did not do. The way that you described it isn't really accurate. In an over $400 million budget, we really voted to cut about $20 million, or about 4%. There were some other police functions that we wanted to keep going, not take any money away from at all, but thought that it might be good to have some civilian or independent oversight, like the forensic lab or internal affairs. We said we wanted to take a look at that. But then there was a large pocket of $50 million that we said we just wanted to take a look at to see whether or not those kinds of police functions should remain as police functions. So when I hear the political debate talking about the city of Austin cutting or defunding the police budget, it's really very different from what we did.
We had a guest on earlier this week, Terry Keel. You probably know who he is, former Travis County Sheriff and former Republican state lawmaker. And he has been part of some have called him the architect of the governor's plan for a possible DPS takeover of Austin police. He says that it is perfectly lawful, provided that lawmakers approve such a change in the next session. Do you have any quarrels with whether or not such a move would be, in fact, legal?
I've been advised that that kind of takeover of police and the takeover of local tax dollars is something that that's not legal. But I've been spending most of my time not on that proposal, but rather focused on the public safety in this community and making sure that that we maintain our position as the safest big city in Texas and one of the safest big cities in the country.
Having said that, is something that he used when he was talking. He talked about a spike in violent crime and in homicides. We have seen those numbers go up. Are you convinced that there isn't an increasing safety issue in the city of Austin?
Well, those numbers are real. I think you have to look at the statistics. So that that story in the Wall Street Journal that people are quoting do point out that Austin had one of the greatest percent increases in homicides. But yet, that same article pointed out that Austin had the second lowest number of homicides in the entire country. And when you have a very small number of homicides, which we're lucky and blessed to have in this city, when you add just a few to that, the percentage increase seems rather large.
Numbers versus percentage, for sure.
Numbers versus percentage. And when you look at all of the cities, and I think there were, you know, on that list, it also listed Houston and Dallas and San Antonio and Fort Worth. All of those cities had a greater number of homicides than did the city of Austin. So a fair reading would indicate that Austin, second safest city in the entire country with respect to homicides.
Steve Adler is the mayor of Austin, Texas. Thank you so much for taking time to speak with us on the Texas Standard, Mayor Adler. We certainly do appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Texas's mostly Republican State Board of Education is revising the state's sex ed curriculum for the first time in more than 20 years. This week, a final proposal for those changes is being taken up by the board. Despite pleas from LGBTQ advocates and educators alike, this proposal shows no sign of addressing LGBTQ issues. And as more than 150,000 Texas youth identify as LGBTQ, many of them are concerned that a lot of these teens will continue to not have access to sex ed they need, at least in the sexual education curriculum. Aaliyah Swaby reports on public education for the Texas Tribune. Aaliyah, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
You recently spoke with an LGBTQ public school student in Texas, and what were some of his concerns about sex ed specifically and the lack of the conversation or what it is that, that this person feels is missing from the curriculum?
So I talked with Atticus Sandlin, who basically has had to become a sex education expert himself at the age of 16, you know, looking through internet research, going to conferences, learning from different advocacy groups, and then being the one to educate his peers. And he's also been in classrooms where his teachers, he's a transgender boy, and his teachers haven't used his preferred pronouns or names. And His argument is that having that kind of comprehensive sex ed curriculum that includes gender identity and sexual orientation would not only help kids like him, but would also help the teachers and the students who are not LGBTQ who should be learning about those things.
You're right. It's not just young people who are pushing for changes. They're educators as well.
Yes. So the State Board of Education held public testimony this week and then also back in June. Mm-hmm. And there were a number of people who showed up to say that they wanted comprehensive sex education and that they wanted it to include lessons about gender identity and sexual orientation. That included people who had gone to Texas public schools and found the information that they learned in their sex education classes lacking, and then also current educators who wanted their kids to be able to learn that.
Texas is notorious in some circles for decades and decades of politics entering the sphere of what is taught and what is not taught in classrooms. Do you get a sense that a lot of this has to do with the politics that surrounds issues like the validation of LGBTQ students' sexual orientation and gender identity colliding with people's religious or political ideologies?
Well, there were a group of people who testified, Texas Values, which is a conservative advocacy organization, among them, that they should be as close to, abstinence-only education as possible, and that they should not include any what they called pro-LGBTQ propaganda in the standards. You can't separate the politics from the way that the curriculum is being developed and the things that are being left out of it.
What's next for the development of this curriculum? What's the next shoe to drop?
The State Board of Education is supposed to be taking a vote today, their preliminary vote on the revision of the health and sex education policy, and there will be a final vote in November. So there's still a ways to go on this. It could change along the way, and I'll be reporting on it throughout.
Aaliyah Swaby is public education reporter for the Texas Tribune. We'll link to her latest at texasstandard.org. Aaliyah, thank you again.
Thank you.
What are Texans talking about on social media? Let's find out. Social media editor Wells Dunbar joins us on this Thursday. Hello there, Wells.
Hi, David. We're hearing from folks about the story at the top of the show, your chat with Austin Mayor Steve Adler, pushing back on these plans, proposals, for the state to take over Austin police. On our Facebook page, Rob Davis asks, what happened to the Republican ideal of self-governing? If crime rises in Austin, then let Austin voters take action by replacing them. This is another government overreach by Republicans that goes against a primary Republican principle of self-determination and small government. And moving from the city to the state to the federal level, President Trump sparking a firestorm on social media with his recorded comments to journalist Bob Woodward back in March, saying that, quote, I always wanted to play it down. I still like playing it down because I don't want to create a panic. Those remarks in reference to the then burgeoning coronavirus pandemic and his basically on the record comments that he knew airborne transmission of the virus was possible. Lots of people picking up on this story, David. I'll be back with more from social media later in the show.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of criticism about Bob Woodward's decision not to publish those remarks until much later as well. We'd love to hear from you, Texas. You know what to do. Look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at SaveNowForCollege.org. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. More today on new data from NPR and Harvard in their study on the impact of the pandemic on major cities. Yesterday, we told you how people in Houston appear to have far more trouble getting medical care and paying for it compared to comparably sized cities. Now, Sarah Willa Ernst reports on what the survey found out about the tremendous financial impact COVID-19 is having in Houston.
Near the George Bush Intercontinental Airport, Ramel Temez works at a warehouse helping prepare in-flight meals for United Airlines catering. But when the airline industry started slashing service this spring, Temez saw his hours cut to part-time, and it's taken a big financial hit on him.
Mostly worried about making rent and light. I'm barely scraping by.
Temez has been struggling to afford food and says he's sleeping more to conserve energy. He feels he's been in free fall financially.
A lot of people are looking for second jobs that are probably also part-time, so it's not really doing much good, and there's not really that much work right now.
Temez is one of many Houstonians finding themselves in this position. Over half of Houston households surveyed say someone has lost their job or their business, has been furloughed, or had hours reduced at their job during the outbreak. About a third report having trouble paying basic expenses like rent, utilities, and food. This data comes from a new report by NPR and Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. They surveyed around 500 households in New York, LA, Chicago, and Houston in July. The report shows that these money struggles fall starkly along racial lines, especially in Houston. Around 80% of Black and Latino households said they're facing serious financial problems, compared to only 30% of white households. That's because white Houstonians tend to have office jobs.
In general, white-collar workers have been more protected from financial declines.
This is Bill Fulton, the director of the Kinder Institute for Urban Research at Rice University. He says office workers have been able to continue their work and stay in business. Service industry jobs, however, that require in-person interaction have struggled to stay open.
There are simply more Black and Hispanic folk who work in those jobs, and so they've been more heavily affected than office workers who are mostly white and also Asian.
Fulton says the financial struggles were already there from the trauma of Hurricane Harvey in 2017. The coronavirus pandemic just piled on top of that.
So the two events together, that one followed the other so closely, that has made this such an extremely difficult situation here in Houston.
Take what happened to Pierre Laws. He's always struggled financially, working as a contract driver and cook. Then Harvey forced him into homelessness.
After Hurricane Harvey, and I lost my car because I lost everything. And I couldn't get any help. I mean, I could get a plate of food. I was living in a tent under the bridge.
He was starting to get back on his feet earlier this year with food stamps and a new apartment through a local nonprofit. But then the pandemic hit, and now he's stuck again. He has underlying conditions that put him at a higher risk for COVID-19. He has a history of lung disease. He has trouble walking, and he's HIV positive. But he says the only jobs available would put him on the front lines.
He said, but I go back and forth through, should I try to get a job? I can't get a job working from here because I don't have the internet. I don't have the money for the internet.
He needs that to go back to school for accounting. He wants a job where he can work from home, but he recently pawned his computer for $30.
But I mean, I don't want to be like this forever, and I want to be able to come out of this on top, not up under.
But for now, like other hard-strapped Houstonians, he's weighing the limited options in his head over and over again. I'm Sarah Willa Ernst in Houston.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. The ways that social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter can and do address political or medical disinformation have been contentious since, well, at least the 2016 election, that's for sure. But now, as online games like Animal Crossing and Fortnite become venues, not just for play, but for political expression, the companies that host these online worlds are being asked how they will handle misleading statements or content produced by players. Here to help us navigate this intersection of games and politics, our tech expert Omar Gallego comes back. Omar, good to have you back on the broadcast.
Hey, excited to talk about games, as always.
Yeah, but this is kind of an unusual intersection. Say it ain't so. Animal Crossing meets election season politics?
There's been a lot of chatter lately about the Biden-Harris campaign releasing yard signs for Animal Crossing. Now, Animal Crossing's New Horizon has been this juggernaut game that became very popular as people stayed home during the pandemic, a very calming, sweet little game, you know, where you build your on this island. But now, you know, politics are part of it. And so, yeah, the Biden campaign released these little yard signs you can put outside your domicile. But then, you know, the Trump campaign, of course, you know, criticized them and said, oh, is that what you're doing now? So it's become a little bit contentious, these little yard signs.
I'm curious about how political disinformation comes in. I mean, it's one thing to post a yard sign in a game saying vote for whomever. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if you have a candidate making an appearance in the game and saying something that is political disinformation, how might it work its way into these platforms?
That's just it. We don't know yet. I mean, we don't know whether there are people out there, you know, creating bots or creating fake accounts for this express purpose of spreading misinformation or to pose as someone, you know, and try to, you know, make friends online in these games. Many of these games are very anonymous. You're playing them with people you will never know or have contact with. So, yeah, there have been instances. The Anti-Defamation League tracked instances of people spreading information about the Holocaust or spreading information, conspiracy theories about 9/11. And these were, you know, just kind of mainstream games that people were playing, but they're getting chatted up or approached by people in these games. What we're seeing so far is that the game companies don't seem to have a real strong approach for dealing with that. They really haven't dealt with it that much in the past.
That's interesting because I know that games have been modded or modified by hardcore fans and other players as well. What's to stop someone from modding a game so that it has an overtly political message?
Oh, that definitely happens. I mean, there's a whole scene of indie games that are created for the express purpose of, you know, throw a pie at this political candidate's face or, you know, punch this person in the face. I mean, there's lots of indie games like that. There have also been mods created for existing games, like the game Civilization had a Putin mod during the 2016 election campaign. And then there was, we find out in 2018 that there was a Russian-made Hillary Clinton game that they were trying to make viral during the 2016 election as well. So there are definitely players, bad players out there creating these games in order to try to gain traction and kind of influence minds. You know, but they're video games. We don't know that that's actually having any kind of real impact.
We should point out that there are some differences between policies on this in the U.S. and in other countries, right?
Right. I mean, for instance, with the Animal Crossing signs, Nintendo has specific policies in Japan, for instance, for no political kind of talk or kind of a campaigning within their games. But that doesn't seem to exist in the U.S. So in the U.S., that seems to be fair game.
So what's the best way for players to deal with information or activity in an online game that is problematic?
Yeah, I think there are not the same kind of controls as there are with social media, with Facebook and Twitter, who've been dealing with this, you know, heavily the last couple of years. There don't seem to be the same kind of triggers in video games to kind of alert mods when that stuff happens organically. So it's up to the players to really vet that stuff, to let community managers know that it's happening, or to block, you know, if you're getting spam or you're getting bad information or harassment from somebody, you know, block them and report them. Most mainstream games, especially big online games, have those mechanisms to be able to report and block content and people.
Omar Gayaga strives to provide only the most accurate information over at TechMinuteTexas.com. Omar, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, David. I appreciate it.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, reminding everyone to keep annual preventive and screening appointments. Early detection is critical to better cancer outcomes, so discussion with a doctor is encouraged. More at TexasOncology.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Lauren Terrazas. The Texas Workforce Commission says federal funds the Trump administration allocated to increase weekly unemployment payments has run out. KERA's Christopher Connolly reports.
Last month, President Donald Trump signed an executive order allowing for a $300 per week boost to most unemployment checks. It was meant to help people cover household expenses. The order came after Congress and the administration allowed a $600 weekly unemployment boost to lapse at the end of July. Now, the Trump administration says the money for the stopgap boost is gone too, and this week's unemployment checks won't include the extra $300. Meanwhile, Congress and the Trump administration don't appear any closer on the next round of coronavirus relief. I'm Christopher Connolly in Dallas.
U.S. Senator Ted Cruz is on President Trump's latest list of potential U.S. Supreme Court nominees. It was released Wednesday. In a statement, the Texas Republican said it was an immense honor to be considered. Also on the list is former Texas Solicitor General and Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals Judge James Ho. Lubbock is continuing to see a significant increase in coronavirus cases driven by new infections among young people. The city's public health authority, Dr. Ron Cook, discussed the trend Wednesday.
Most of the new positives are in the age group of 18 to 24. So how do we stop that? We've got to avoid the big parties. We've got to avoid the big house parties and the big pool parties and avoid other social events where there's great big gatherings. You must wear your facial covering and certainly keep your social distance.
Cook said there are more than 600 active cases on the Texas Tech University campus alone. A New York Times analysis finds Lubbock is among the metro areas with the worst COVID-19 outbreaks, ranking 16th nationwide. Millions of Texans still need to be counted before the U.S. Census ends on its expedited deadline of September 30th. So far, about 86% of households in the state have been tallied either through people self-responding to the survey or census workers following up in person. Katie Martin Lightfoot is the Census Community Engagement Coordinator at the think tank Every Texan. She explains one of the consequences of an inaccurate count.
In Texas, if we have an undercount of just 1%, a conservative estimate is that we will lose $300 million per year for the next 10 years.
She reminds residents they can still fill out the 2020 census online, by phone, or by mail. I'm Lauren Tarrazas for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the Texas Department of Agriculture. Because of educators and school nutrition professionals, over 5 million Texas children have daily access to nutritious school meals, many including local products. Learn more at farmfreshfriday.org.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. The troubles Texas's businesses are facing due to COVID-19 are well known, each of us affected in one way or another, but Texas's breweries, distilleries, and wineries have been hit particularly hard, in part due to a series of declarations by Texas Governor Greg Abbott that puts them in a similar category as bars, and as you know, bars are closed for the most part. The Texas Wine and Grape Growers Association is responding in a way it has never done before, creating a political action committee, and the president of the association joins us now. Patrick Whitehead, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hi, David. Good morning.
Tell us about this political action committee. The Texas wine industry sure has grown a lot in a short period of time.
It has, and we were all caught off guard, as most everyone was, with the second shutdown that affected manufacturers' tasting rooms. And after a few weeks of trying to make our case to the task force and to the governor's office, we realized we probably just needed to get together and try a different strategy. So the Political Action Committee Save Texas Wineries was formed in August, and here we are today.
Well, to have a strategy, of course, you need to have an objective. What are you hoping to accomplish?
Well, I mean, the first thing is to get wineries back open and allow them to operate their businesses in the way that they're legally allowed to operate them. Some of us have reopened, but we're having to do it more under the guise of being a restaurant. And there's still several that haven't opened. So our goal here is, again, to have the emergency order lifted or find a way to get those tasting rooms open.
You know, when I hear political action committee, I think of two different bits of leverage, I suppose you could say. On the one hand, members of a political action committee can lobby their lawmakers. On the other hand, political action committees can raise money to try to get other lawmakers elected. What are you thinking now?
Well, I think it's both of those things. And the other thing is trying to engage the people that have a passion and have an affinity for Texas wine and grapes and get them engaged as well, so that the folks in Austin know that it's not just the business owners that are making our case and are trying to be heard, but people that support us.
How much leverage does the wine industry have in Texas? I think some people may be surprised to hear that there are something like 520 wineries in the Lone Star State and that Texas is the fifth wine-producing state in the nation. I think that might surprise some lawmakers, too, because it wasn't that long ago the phrase Texas wine might have sounded to some ears like an oxymoron.
Exactly. My winery, Blue Ostrich, is 9 years old. When we were licensed, we were number 225. And so, as you said, there's over 500 now. This has happened very quickly. There's a good many of them that are actually production wineries, actually growing grapes, making wine, that sort of thing. So, yeah, I think lawmakers would be surprised. We've had some great support, but still the governor doesn't seem like he's ready to move on anything.
Do you think he's being overly cautious when it comes to the pandemic?
I don't know if it's being overly cautious or it's the people around the governor. And you've got to understand, David, politics is fairly new to me. So I'm learning as I go. But for all we know, the governor has heard the word wineries and lumped us in there with bars. For the most part, most of us close when the sun goes down. Most of us are serving people who are seated. It's people of a certain age that are there to learn and about the ag part of it and the processes and those kinds of things versus just going to a place for the purpose of consuming alcohol. It's a very different sort of experience.
How much has your business been hurt? What are you hearing from others in the industry?
you know, 40 to 50% of being off the mark is not unusual. You know, we do have the ability to ship in Texas, and a lot of us have really tried to innovate. There have been a lot of things like virtual tastings. I think we figured out to do things a little bit differently.
May I ask how a virtual tasting works?
Sure. People actually will go online and order the wines that we're going to feature in a virtual tasting. We ship those to them. Then we have a set date, and it'll be done via, you know, a Zoom presentation or Facebook Live or YouTube, something like that. And the winemaker or somebody there from the tasting room will actually do the presentation, maybe even do a food pairing, and people can engage and talk to them and that sort of thing. Yeah.
That sounds like fun, but this is, of course, serious business here, and for many wineries, I would imagine, a question or a matter of survival. Is there some point at which you're looking, if things don't change, the industry could be facing irreparable damage?
Oh, I think so. I think there may be some people that don't come back from this. That's very scary. It's very sad. We've worked hard to, as you mentioned earlier, to put ourselves in that position of being the number five wine-producing state in the United States. We've got Texas wines that have been recognized on the world stage at competitions in San Francisco, Lyon, France, things like that. We'd sure hate to see ourselves slide backwards after all the work we've done.
How far off do you think you might be from that sort of point of reckoning?
You know, we'd sure like to see something happen before the end of the year. You know, some folks are running out of dry powder. As I said, some of us have been able to reopen in a limited capacity, and that's one of the things the PAC is asking, the right to be able to open safely, follow the same guidelines that restaurants are allowed to do, nothing different than that.
We've been talking to Patrick Whitehead, he is owner of Blue Ostrich Winery and Vineyard, about the new Texas Winery PAC, Save Texas Wineries. Mr. Whitehead, thanks so much for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
Dave, it's been my pleasure. Cheers.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where faculty do research for the greater good, like biology professor Dean Williams, who uses genetic mapping to help save the horned lizard from extinction. TCU, lead on.
My name is Donald Peacock. I teach 8th grade science, and I work at Yes Prep 5th Ward. I grew up in, like, Acres Homes, so, like, the north side of Houston, so give back to the place that I, you know, kind of came from. I feel prepared, but 2020 keeps making me, like, second-guess myself because, like, I can't really test a lot of the teacher moves and teacher, like, skills that I'm learning because, like, when you're on a video call and you don't see the kid's face, I don't even know if they got the material. And granted, I could use all of my teacher moves like, hey, like, respond to the chat, but if they're not responding, like, I don't really want to, like, penalize or, like, you know, reprimand them for something that's kind of out of their control, you know? I don't want to, like, force them to be motivated about school when, like, maybe they're facing an eviction the next week. It's very hard trying to take these valuable schedule tools, but use them during a pandemic. I'm excited to meet my kids. I only met, like, half of them. Like, because we do, like, an A and a B day, so I met A day kids. So now I'm gonna meet B day kids. Even though, like, only, like, two or three had their cameras on, they were very excited to see me. So, like, I love that, you know, that good energy. They came in there and they were like, hi, I'm Mr. Peacock. And I was like, hi, whoever that is, because it's, like, 20 of them. So, like, I couldn't really determine whose voice it was. So it was very nice to, like, finally, like, hear or see a child and be like, hey, like, welcome to the class.
That's 8th grade teacher Donald Peacock. That segment produced by Houston Public Media. Live music has become one of the greatest cultural casualties of COVID-19, but as venues are shuttered and tours are canceled, a group of San Antonio musicians is trying to keep their creative chops up while helping out the community. Texas Public Radio's Dominic Anthony Walsh reports.
Back in January 2017, a new San Antonio band called Booty Feet dropped its first record. In a now nostalgic scene, people packed a house to the brim for the release show. Later that year, the band put out another record with this song, Church Candy. San Antonio musician Victoria Acuna, also known as Vicky Burb, was an early fan, and she covered the song for the new album, SA Covers for a Cause.
Way back when, somebody had shared that song with me in a playlist and we would listen to it all the time. Well, it was like more than a friend who shared it with me. And so it kind of came a little special to me in that way. Unfortunately, that meaning doesn't really hold anymore, but the sort of like history behind it is attached to me in that way.
For Acuna, the song is a nostalgic throwback to a failed relationship and for the local music community, to a band that no longer exists. Booty Feet broke up last year. On the album, Acuna completely remakes the song, stripping it down to a skeleton. It's a compelling reimagination, where Booty Feet previously vamped under reverb-soaked vocals. Acuna now draws on her classical training as a violinist to create an entirely different texture. When I showed the cover to Noah Escamilla, the member of Booty Feet who wrote Church Candy, he tears up.
That's beautiful. That's so freaking cool. it's almost like I think it's a better rendition of what I did, like, than what we did. Like that it kind of like fits more of the sentiment of the song, you know, I guess more of what I was feeling like when I was writing it. Like, you know. Victoria's such a good musician.
This cover is on a new album of old songs. 18 San Antonio musicians covered other local artists. The record is available for purchase on the popular DIY distribution platform Bandcamp, and all proceeds go to the San Antonio Food Bank. The project is the brainchild of Matthew San Martin, another member of the San Antonio music community. First and foremost, he wants to help feed San Antonio, which suffers from some of the highest levels of food insecurity and economic inequality in the country.
Texas is a very food insecure state. And what we're trying to do with this album is, you know, try to help the people in our hometown, in our community, through the power of music.
The project also kept him busy. He just graduated from St. Edward's University.
I can't stress enough how, like, any sort of job prospect or idea that I wanted to work on prior to the pandemic was just totally gone. And so I was just kind of, you know, like most of the class of 2020, or just students in general, just kind of feeling really down.
But now he's getting a master's degree in journalism innovation from Syracuse University, which has one of the top journalism programs in the country. For the 18 musicians who contributed, this album also serves as a virtual reunion of sorts. The San Antonio DIY music experience is often fleeting. Many artists don't record their music, and a lot of musicians spend the school year out of town, like Victoria Acuna, who goes to school in Boulder, Colorado. The pandemic canceled hundreds of shows slated to happen over the summer, one of the only times of the year when she's in town.
I hate it. I think that's the best way to put it. I really, really hate this situation. I have just been doing music and performance ever since I was a little kid, from like little piano recitals to orchestra concerts to like house shows that I put together with my friends. And that is like, that is so central to who I am and the community that I'm a part of.
Noah Escamilla from Booty Feet had taken a break from performing during the months before the pandemic, but he still attended shows and hung out with the community, which he now sorely misses.
But that's also compounded with a really deep sort of regret that I have for taking so much time off of music before the pandemic, because once the pandemic hit, it's not like I can like go back, you know?
But the album did allow him to channel some creative energy. While one of his songs is covered by Vicky Burp, he adds a cover of his own, his take on a song by a long-beloved San Antonio band. Buttercup. This is their song, Kite.
The allegory is about, you know, grief is a kind of kite that pulls you with the wind. And you have to allow yourself to feel it before it kind of crashes down and falls back.
Noah's harsher vocals and heavier instrumentation conveys that grief more overtly than the original song.
I think it's relevant to the times that we're going to right now. I mean, with a we're experiencing as a culture, as you know, as community, an unprecedented level of loss of our friends, our loved ones, you know, due to a global pandemic. And the scale of that loss is hard to grapple with. I mean, I think everybody's kind of come to terms with it, with the difficulty of just wrestling with what the world has become.
Love, grief, and nostalgia permeate this album of reimagined songs. When live shows resume sometime in the future, this record will serve as a reminder of a time when San Antonio's music scene fell silent. I'm Dominic Anthony Walsh in San Antonio.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Since May 25th, the United States has been reckoning with racism in new ways. Of course, racism is a problem that predates this country, but the police killing of George Floyd has brought it once again to the forefront. It's in this context that a memo came out from the executive office of the president on Friday. It begins, quote, "It has come to the president's attention that executive branch agencies have spent millions of taxpayer dollars to date training," and that's in quotation marks, "government workers to believe divisive anti-American propaganda," close quote. The memo is referring to training on critical race theory. For some reaction to this, we turn to Peniel Joseph. He is the Barbara Jordan Chair in Ethics and Political Values at the LBJ School of Public Affairs. He's also a professor of history and founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at the University of Texas at Austin. Professor Joseph, welcome back to the Texas Standard, and thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
What do you make of this move by the president? What's this announcement telling you?
Well, I think it's a really desperate announcement to try to halt any kind of anti-racism training that the federal government is sponsoring, especially in this context of Black Lives Matter and George Floyd. But if anything, it's an effort to ratchet up his base. This and the assaults against the 1619 Project, which is an endeavor to teach about racial slavery and American history, have really been looked upon by the president and his allies as assaults, not just on the United States, but on assaults on their conception of the United States as really this bastion and birthplace of white nationalism.
For those who may not be familiar, we should probably talk a little bit about the 1619 Project first.
Well, the project is a Pulitzer Prize-winning project by the journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones. So it starts in 1619, Jamestown, and sort of looks at the way in which slavery has impacted healthcare and voting and agriculture, even insurance companies that placed insurance leases on enslaved human beings. So it's been a very extraordinary project in that way.
And President Trump had something to say about the 1619 Project too, right?
Yeah, he says that people are, you know, trying to mess with our history. It's not anti-American to talk about racial slavery. It's not anti-American to talk about social justice movements. It's really giving us a much more holistic understanding to why we arrive at the place we have this year with Black Lives Matter and the largest social justice movement mobilization in American history.
Nothing that a politician says between now and election day, certainly not a president running for re-election, is going to be done without some sort of calculus. And I wonder, well, just how calculated do you think this is? And do you think that the president's remarks reflect at all how Americans have been reacting to renewed conversations about racism and that sort of thing?
Well, I think it's extraordinarily calculated. It's divisive, and it's meant to be. We have the most partisan president in American history. This is a president who truly is not president of the United States, but is president of really anybody who's willing to support him. And that's not what the job calls for. The job calls for statesmanship, because many people are going to disagree with you, and you're still always trying to lean into that disagreement to expand not just your base, but expand just a notion of consensus nationally.
I suspect, though, that people who support President Trump might say that the president's, been calling these trainings divisive. I presume you do not consider that a fair reading of critical race theory. But aren't we at a point where both sides are pointing fingers at each other and saying what you're doing is fundamentally divisive and un-American?
Well, I don't think there's a moral equivalency. I would say that when somebody's trying to root out racism and sort of institutionalize anti-racism, I think that's different from somebody who's saying, you know what, I'm fine with white supremacy or colorblind racism. People who make a claim of not seeing race, but we see racism in the disparities all around us, mm-hmm. but we just stubbornly say we don't see race. So I don't think those are morally equivalent. I would say that what's so extraordinary about 2020 is that when we think about the millions of Americans who've protested in the wake of George Floyd, we see, especially the numbers of white Americans like we've never seen, the president is really ignoring them. Right now, we've seen a greater upsurge of national mobilization that is anti-racist than that is willing to double down on the status quo.
Peniel Joseph is the Barbara Jordan Chair in Ethics and Political Values at the LBJ School of Public Affairs. He's also a professor of history and founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at the University of Texas at Austin. Professor Joseph, good to have you back on the broadcast. Thanks again.
I enjoyed our conversation.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar has been monitoring what Texans are talking about on social media on this Thursday. What are you seeing, Wells?
Hey, David. Well, we've been hearing from folks about lots of topics on the show. Returning to another one from earlier, that discussion about the State Board of Education and how it's taking another pass at sex ed standards for the state, and the question of what it means for LGBTQ students. This tweet to us from Katie Hayes. She says, instead of referring to these as LGBTQ issues, could you say that we want LGBTQ identity included? She says, like, we just want LGBTQ kids to be acknowledged rather than negated by omission. Not a huge ask. And so that's an interesting perspective on how this debate is framed going forward. Not simply a question of inclusion. So an interesting and worthwhile response to mention there. Just scanning tweet deck for some other headlines here. I see a report here close to home to you and I, David, from the Daily Texan. That's the student newspaper of the University of Texas, and they write, breaking, UT Austin reports three clusters in the West Campus with a total of approximately 100 positive COVID-19 cases. They write that the university declined to name the location of the cluster, citing federal and state law. Story to come. And I would note, David, that this does come as we near the kickoff of UT football, which by last I saw was still slated to continue at Darrell K. Royal Stadium there in the middle of the University of Texas at Austin this Saturday. I believe the attendance was capped at 25,000, which is a quarter of what it can hold, but obviously lots of concern and some consternation out there mm-hmm. about whether or not this is the right thing to do at this time.
Schools having difficulty, colleges and universities in particular, having difficulty sort of keeping a lid on the spread of COVID-19. Something, I don't know whether you've seen a lot of this on social media. I sort of saw a tweet about it, but apparently Ted Cruz, the junior senator from Texas, has wound up on President Trump's short list of potential nominees to the Supreme Court. He does this apparently each year. He adds more names to his list of potential nominees. And of course, this in an election year, I believe he also has added Tom Cotton of Arkansas and Josh Hawley of Missouri to that list. Interesting stuff. And I know that it's creating a lot of buzz on social media.
That's for sure. Yeah, folks sounding off on our Facebook page and Yeah, definitely. That would be interesting. Supreme Court Justice Ted Cruz. Yep. Can you imagine?
You know, if you'd like to sound off on our Facebook page, you know what to do. Just look for Texas Standard, or you can send us a message via Twitter or your social media platform of choice. As always, Wells Dunbar, our social media editor, is looking for you. We hope you'll join us on our website, texasstandard.org, anytime 24/7. And of course, we hope you'll join us again on the radio tomorrow.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.